be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hello, welcome to Vintage Annals Archive Outsider Podcast. This is Richie Wexler. I'm very excited to have a guest today named Taylor Mack. It's probably not great form to start a podcast, admitting you didn't know a lot about the guests when you started, which is true. I'm pretty narrow in what I like sometimes. But that being said, the first time I'd heard about them was when watching their documentary, Taylor Mack's 24-Decade History of Popular Music, that was on HBO Max. And it just blew me away to a point where I had to track down Taylor for a good amount of time to make sure I could talk to them about that documentary and that theater piece. Again, if you haven't watched the documentary Taylor Mack's 24-Decade History of Popular Music, please watch it. And then if you can, go see their new show, Bark of Millions. It had its premiere at the Sydney Opera House. It is in New York at BAM from February 5th through the 10th. And then it's moving on to the West Coast, February 23rd to 25th. I highly recommend it. I'm going to try to get to one of these myself. I'm going to give you a little bit of blurb. Read a little bit of the blurb from Bark of Millions. A powerhouse collective of international artists ignite an electrifying collision of performance, live music, and drag spectacle in the latest from theater-making renegades Taylor Mack, Matt Ray, and Machine Dazzle. The team unleashes their creativity in a rock opera meditation on queerness, featuring 55 original songs by Mack and Ray and a bevy of costumes by Dazzle with a fierce elation of a pride parade. Bark of Millions is a luxuriant, provocative spectacle unlike any other. If you've been listening to our podcast, you know we've been playing around a little bit with new formats. I've been trying to connect two people that know each other to get a better conversation. I was able to reach out to my friend Earl Dax, who's been doing queer performance work behind the scenes and in front of the and as a performer who has my favorite drag name of all time, Enya Buttocks. It's just the best drag name ever. I'm sorry, everybody else. That's the best one. But it was really cool when I reached out to Earl. They're like, oh, I put on some of Taylor's first shows. So, you know, it was great to have them as part of this as well. And I've known them for 20 some years, and they are a doll and an interesting artist as well. So enjoy. Please check out our other episodes. There's a lot of good things happening here. Please follow us on Instagram, Vintage Annals Archive, and please follow the podcast. There's some great stuff here. And again, this is one of our biggest. I don't think I've ever had anybody with this many awards I've ever talked to for the podcast. And Taylor Mack, just getting to know them was such a treat. Such an amazing person. I also got to know a little bit about Machine Dazzle, who's a big part of Taylor's work, and they're also amazing, and we're hoping to get to talk to them one of these days as well. So enjoy. Thank you. The best thing I found on when I looked you up was the description of you being the mixture of Ziggy Stardust and Tiny Tim. Is that something you created, or is that something somebody else came up with?
No, that was somebody wrote that in a review. They said I was a combination of Ziggy Stardust and Tiny Tim because I played the ukulele and I, you know, wore these crazy outfits, and they were kind of not really gender ambiguous to me. It seemed very little ambiguity about them, but you know, to the larger world, I think there was, they would label them ambiguous. And so then when that person wrote that, then a lot of people, you know, what I've noticed about journalists is they tend to just read what has been written and then they cut and paste a little bit.
Yeah.
So that started to get, I started to get labeled that. That was, and so I needed a palate cleanser show, which is a show that I can make in a couple days after I've worked on something for a long time. And so I thought I'd make a show that addresses comparison and how it's violence and why we use it and how we use it. And we could just like sing some Tiny Tim songs and some David nice. Bowie songs and squish them all together. And so that's how that started.
Okay.
It was never really meant to be like some major opus, but I ended up touring the world with it. So
there you go. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate. I mean, I also, I'm starting to feel like an asshole for having asked you that now, but you know.
That's what it was. Yeah. I mean, now I think at the time I was trying to identify myself in the world, or I was trying to build I hate the word, but career, you know, I was trying to build something so that I could do what I wanted to do without needing to do too much bullshit, you know. So I think being compared to other artists that were more famous than I certainly was, and having my identity taken from me right as I was getting to go, felt a little bit like, fuck you,
Yeah.
I wanted, but now I don't think if someone said that now, I'd probably just laugh and it'd be funny and I'd move on, you know. But it's interesting what power dynamics do to an opinion.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm being honest, I would never... The Tiny Tim, I would have never. I mean, the Bowie is in there somewhere, but I would never.
Well, I played the ukulele. Tim. That's what.
But that's just somebody looking at a minute and a half of your on your YouTube and then making a judgment.
That's the great deep sorrow that I have about criticism in America. Although this quote was from England, so it applies to the Brits too. But is that there is such a lack of consideration. It's all very quick, you know. You got a deadline and you got to like come up with fast things to assume about a person and assume about an art. It's not about consideration, which really it's the unending sadness I have with the way people talk about art in the world.
Yeah,
but Earl has never been that way. So that's why I was drawn to Earl.
I want to get into this. I want to know how you connected. It seems like politically you're both in line. I feel like you're both probably very subversive in different ways. So I'm just curious on how you met, what connected you, and how you started working together. And then kind of from there, how the friendship happened, if you want to dig into that a little bit.
I don't have a memory of how we met. Do you?
I mean, I don't have like a specific, like that was the moment and there's like a filmic sort of scenario. I just know that I was living in Philadelphia. I was coming up to New York pretty regularly. I had met Marga Gomez in San Francisco and she came to Philadelphia to do a show at the Painted Bride. We really hit it off and I came up and I was visiting her at her place in Williamsburg. And then she, you know, took me, I think she was performing in a Murray Hill show. So I got, you know, then it was just the whole cast of characters. And I think I probably saw you first at Doppelbanger or something, like one of the nightclubs you were performing at.
that was my night.
Yeah.
So we had this, there was this very tiny basement bar called The Slide, which had been 5 million other clubs over the years. And they let me take over a night there. So I had this party. It was a once a week party and I'd do a different original performance art piece every week and then have guests come once a week. Like Scotty the Blue Bunny or the world famous Bob or the Dazzle Dancers or somebody like that. And they do something. And so that was, it was called Doppelbanger. Yeah. And so maybe that's where we met. That was
something like
that's where I met Maddie and Daryl and the whole crew. Yeah.
How did you both get into this? I know you both perform. I know you're both kind of curators. Did you both kind of get into this through both those avenues?
Well, it's interesting. I don't really know that about Taylor. I know you went to American Academy of Dramatic Art, right? And then how did you get into drag performance?
Yeah, I wanted to be an actor and I was my I would do a little drag here and there in San Francisco, but it wasn't, I did had no concept of it as something that you would do for your art. It was just this thing that you did for fun, which probably should have stayed that way. But but anyways, I came to New York to be an actor, and I went to acting school, and then I started writing plays. I found that in New York, there were too many barriers to be, to even get auditions. I couldn't, I tried for 7 years to get auditions for anything, and I just couldn't get auditions, literally. But I'm a creative person, and I can't stop, you know, that's, yeah. I'm unhappy if I'm not making things. So I just started writing and kind of seeing a different kind of art that wasn't available to me when I was a kid. You didn't grow up being told the option, you could be Mabu Mines. You could be, you know, they tell you the option is Broadway. And so there was some adjustment time where I got to kind of learn by watching and seeing what the options were and thinking, you know, what do I actually want to make instead of what I grew up being told to make, you know? And so that took some time, I think, and a lot of people had died of AIDS. So there weren't a lot, like the Harry Condolians of the world weren't around. And the ones that were around were kind of licking their wounds. Like all those pyramid queens weren't really doing much when I first moved to the city.
What are the pyramid queens? I need to know what that is.
Well, like Hattie Hathaway and all of them were all, they were taking a little break, I think, from the scene. I don't know if Hattie ever really took a break from the scene, but they were like, you know, there seemed to be a period where people were in trauma mode, where they weren't from AIDS, and they were,
yeah,
the survivors weren't, you know,
was pyramid didn't
feel
venue
like
was,
going to a party and of course was, another was, party and, you know.
Yeah, of course. I'm curious, is a pyramid, was that a club, what was a pyramid piece? That's what
yeah
I,
the pyramid was a, well, maybe Earl, you could probably describe it better than I could.
The Pyramid Club on Avenue A in the East Village. It was just kind of a hotbed of performance in, I guess, would have been late 70s, early 80s. I mean, it still exists, but Hattie Hathaway performed there later
John
on.
John Kelly and Ethel Eichelberger and Blue Lips and, you know, all these kind of alternative drag queens, which is the only phrase that I have for kind of what we do, which is like art drag, you know, not so much female impersonation drag or lip sync, but I mean, there's some lip sync in it, but it's primarily, it's, you know, from a perspective of making art. And they were, you know, for the most part, anti-capitalists and, like, you know, interesting people, and anti-normative etiquette kind of activists, I would say, you know?
I mean, it seems like, you know, from my understanding, that whole performance world is really tied to activism. One, I think, as a way to deal with all of it, and two, as a way to like not make it so heavy all the time. But I had two quick questions about like your background, because there's two things I thought was interesting in terms of doing some research, that you had said that Charles Ludham in the Theater of Ridiculous was an influence. Again, this could have been some lazy reporters. Things, I'm just putting that out there because it seems interesting to me.
I mean, it's what's interesting about that to me is, I mean, of course they've been, because they influenced everyone who influenced me.
Right.
I didn't know them.
You didn't know them. Okay,
know anything about their work when I first started making work.
Yeah.
So of course they've been an influence, but what I'm more interested in is the passion that the downtown community has towards assigning them an influence to me.
Gotcha.
Because there is a deep, deep, deep desire that they not be forgotten. And so I think they've latched a little bit more importance to what I do than is accurate, but I there's this part of me that just kind of goes, yeah, okay, just take it, because it's clear that this is important. And yeah, but I don't, yeah, if you look at my work and you really look at Charles Ludlum's work, they're very, it's very different.
Generally,
so I've always felt a little uneasy yeah. with the label, just because I don't want to misrepresent something, you know. It's really not the ridiculous what I do, but this is a very specific kind of concept of theater making, theater of the ridiculous.
Yeah, generally I used to do about anywhere from 10 to 15 hours of research. And it worked the opposite way. I knew too much about someone to have a regular conversation, so I err on the side of less. One thing that I did see that was interesting. Again, this could be that your mother ran a private art school. Did that have? Yeah. I'm wondering. You know, it seemed like it was like a hippie, you know, like a hippie-ish school, like art. And I'm wondering if there was any freedom in there of being taught art in a very unique way that did influence anything. And if someone has misspoken about your mother, I will come after them.
No, I mean, I don't think anyone really misspeaks about any of this stuff. Everyone's just shooting darts at walls. My mom ran an art school, and you know, I always hated it when I was a kid, but as an adult, as an adult, I have some, you know, hindsight appreciation for what it was. And she really encouraged the kids to, it wasn't about drawing figurative. It was abstract art. She had an abstract art school.
Oh, wow.
And you know, it's not like the figurative didn't end up happening from time to time, but she really encouraged people to, the kids to use their imaginations. And I think that was true of my childhood it's obviously had a major effect on who I've become and what I do.
Like, I guess I'm a little more curious on just her as a mother, her as a person in terms of influencing.
I should just say it was like a little private art school, like after school kind of thing. It was, you know, there were like 10 kids per class. And, you know, I think she ended up making a profit the last couple of years of its existence, but she basically ran it like almost folding for 20 years, you know? So it's not like it wasn't some big art school thing. It was like, it was like in our living room for the first few years. And then they moved to a space and, you know,
I asked that question because,
like, you know, $20 for your kid to take 2 hour art class
that's as much
after school, you know? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. I only ask that question because this is kind of tied to 24 hour performance, is that it's, I don't know if like, I assume you have a lot of a knowledge of history of music and of LGBT culture. And I'm curious, you know, it seems like you made a decision that was, whether it was purposeful or not, that you're, I mean, I look at the documentary and the performance as educational. Almost by design, like that to me, I've done a lot of work building. I'm a special ed teacher, but also have focused on more like LGBTQIA education and all kinds of stuff. And I could build an entire curriculum around that performance of the history and also the music and the history of the music and just the way you put it all out there. And even you starting with talking about Stonewall, I just think, do you feel like there's a teacher in you somewhere? Do you feel like education was a piece of this or not? Am I again on the wrong track?
Nah.
I'm gonna go cry.
There's no wrong track.
Whether or not you designed it like that way, it's such a unique educational resource. If people pay attention between the artist, the songs, the people you talk about, I mean, it's a book in there. There's a book in there, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I'd be suspect of anyone learning from me in terms of like facts.
It's why you'd be a good teacher.
I'm definitely subjective in all facts.
Yeah.
So I would not trust my take on history to be the take on history. But
it wasn't a shot glass?
Yeah.
Well,
even that is, I mean, the truth of the matter is that, and this is from her, not from me or, you know, a historian, but the truth is that Marjorie B. Johnson didn't throw the shot glass at Stonewall. And, you know, like that she says herself that she wasn't there. So on the first night. So, I mean, that's, you know, there's audio of her saying she wasn't there
yes.
on the first night. So
this is not
but
accurate.
What I think is fascinating is that people are so, people have decided that she's the person. And so that need, that desire is more interesting than who actually did it to me. The collective desire to have it be her and to champion that very specific person who was such an outsider artist and such an interesting soul. So, and Black and trans. And so, you know, in that, like all of the, it's like what the community doing activism to support that person who's not the kind of person that anyone didn't have violence in their heart, but also not the kind of person that you would invite over to the boardroom, you know?
Right.
So what is it about our, what special thing in our community is saying, that's the person we're going to hold up. You know, I think that's really very special.
What are your thoughts on that, Earl? What are your thoughts on like this kind of, I guess, well, I don't know if labeling is a good way to put it, but kind of, you know, putting stamps on things that aren't necessarily accurate for certain purposes. Have you seen that kind of same stuff in terms of your activism? I know you go, my understanding is you go way back to like ACT UP in Philadelphia. After this question, I have to talk about Enya Buttocks because to this day, that is my favorite. There's never been a drag name that's ever been better than Enya Buttocks. It does not exist. I've not heard it. I don't want to hear it. But I'm just curious on just talking about this stuff. How did you, you know?
Well, I guess in a way, not unlike Taylor, I had pursued acting in a more conventional sense. I moved to Los Angeles after high school.
Oh, wow.
You know, I did Equity Waiver Theater and, you know, was trying to get my SAG card. I was one of the people under the stairs in the Wes Craven film of that name. My SAG eligibility, but I couldn't afford to pay the membership dues, so I never did get my SAG card. You know, I moved to the East Coast doing an AmeriCorps program in Maryland. Cool. And after I graduated, actually, during the program, I would come up to Philadelphia and I saw an advertisement for Grassroots Queers in the back of the city paper. And I remember going up these two flights of narrow stairs, this building on 13th Street. It was at Albo's Loft, and it was the Grassroots Queers, through Direct Action Group, shared office space with ACT UP Philadelphia. And I was so trepidatious, and I didn't know what to expect. And, you know, I found this world of, you know, smart, passionate, intelligent, queer activists. And so I moved to Philadelphia when I was actually thrown out of the AmeriCorps program.
I have to ask why. No. We have time. How do you get thrown out of AmeriCorps? They find burnout hippies. That's how they get people. Just burnout hippies who were like falling asleep. Come join us. How did you get thrown out of that?
I completed a full year, and then I was invited back as a team leader, and it's kind of a long story, but it was a poorly run program. There was an incident with a friend of ours who is a core member the first year, and she had been randomly tested for drugs, and she went in and threw herself on the mercy of the director and confessed to having done blow. And then during one of our in-service days when we do training, the one of the educational directors made her, I remember we half of us were in wheelchairs to experience what it was like to be
no.
and my friend Tara was in a
better.
Wheelchair and they made her get up in front of all 60 core members and confess to having taken cocaine. And she was like in tears.
No.
And then like 2 weeks later, the director of the campus had to admit that she had tested negative because the lawyer for AmeriCorps told him that he had to say, you know, that be honest with her. She hadn't actually tested positive.
What?
So they had put her through this whole thing, you know. Anyway, so it caused an uproar amongst, and of course, you know, Enya Buttocks, the drag queen for social and economic justice. I hadn't yet, you know, donned the wig, but that spirit of activism was still coursing through my veins, and so I was indignant and kind of led the charge. So I came back the next year
Oh my God.
already on, you know, sort of eggshells with the administration. They were, I was not their favorite person. So anyway, you know, it
Oh
followed
God,
very
they're so
quickly
fed
that I was.
up.
I love that
So
story.
anyway,
I'm
but I moved
sorry.
to,
All
I'm
so
so dysfunctional. Just, ugh.
It was very dysfunctional, but you know, but the bright side is I moved to Philadelphia. I got, you know, more involved with grassroots queers, you know, Maddie Hart, Spiral Q Puppet Theater, the Radical Fairies. That was my introduction to the Radical Fairies in Philadelphia, the Sorbet Circles, Albo, Peter Leon, Chris Bart, Lady Bartlett. And yeah, so, you know, I had been an aspiring actor, performer, what have you. And when I came to Philadelphia, I was working full time and taking part time classes at Penn. And I went to Bob and Barbara's for the Thursday night drag shows, and I saw an opportunity to perform. Actually, I think Ricky Kelly and DJ K-Tel was doing the Dumpster Players. And I was, you know, and so anyway, for me, it was like, oh, I had very limited time. I couldn't commit to a rehearsal process for a traditional play. And here was an opportunity to perform in, you know, doing drag and then, you know, being involved with grassroots queers. It just kind of made sense that my drag alter ego would be, you know, fighting for social justice.
Well, right now, I mean, Ricky, you know, I was in the Dumpster Players briefly for about a year, and Ricky comes also from ACT UP as well. So, you know, I just think there's an amazing history of LGBTQ drag, whether it's to drag or other performance of protest, which, you know, I think the best way to kind of talk about dark things is through comedy and performance. And I think it's so smart. And also, I think there's a healing there. Like, how else do you, you just can't start screaming and crying. Like, if you went up to the stage and really express it, you would just cry and scream at people for 30 minutes, which I'm sure people have done, but I don't know how effective it is.
Exactly.
Not crying, but the screaming part.
Yeah. But with coffee.
We love Penny. We love Penny.
How did it go from, was it performance world first to activism? Was it from, how have you seen it? How have you guys used it in your own? Let's talk about yourselves. How did that, what was that useful for you? Did that come from there? Yes or no? You know, how did you see the mixture of the world of performance and activism in terms of any, you know, whether it's, you know where I'm going? I'm sorry. I'm asking
Very
long questions.
I think I can bring this around. So, you know, for me, you know, when I lived in Los Angeles, it was very much about direct service. Like I was part, you know, I was a volunteer with AIDS Project Los Angeles, Project Angel Food, delivering food to homebound people with AIDS. And then I was doing the AmeriCorps program, which was again kind of service and, you know, working in schools and these sorts of things. And Philadelphia for me was really like a political education and, you know, political consciousness forming for me through the grassroots queers and West Philly anarchists and things like this. And so for me, when I started going to New York City and encountering artists like Taylor and these downtown performers, it was so exciting because for the first time I experienced people on stage that were speaking truths that really resonated with me as a queer person, you know, that really spoke to my sense of social justice and activism. And, you know, not all those performers are, you know, quote, you know, dyed in the wool activists, but I think there's like something about the work, the honesty, the outrageousness, the queerness, the flamboyance, that just like really excited me. And that is, you know, that was the pipeline to me, you know, doing what I eventually did both in Philadelphia and New York, because I just was so excited to, you know, to experience this type of work. And I felt, you know, like a kind of messianic fervor. People must know these artists are so, you know, they're saying it's
It
just.
was really wonderful to meet Earl at the time because there was there to me there were like two kind of producers in New York City, and one was the one that maybe had Earl's energy when they were 20, but had like just been beaten down by board meetings and raising money and galas and the way that the world works. And the other was the kind that just you know, wanted the board meeting and wanted capitalism involved in theater, and you know, and so Earl was like this light of it was just pure energy and in it for all the right reasons, and just like just wanting the world to know about that, found something special and wanting that to be seen and heard by you know people for the purpose of breaking some of these social dictates and rules and systemic issues that we all are living under. And so that was Earl had this passion, and it just was so rare to find, even in with the millions of people that are in New York City, it was so rare to find somebody with that much passion. So it was a total delight to
Oh,
get
that's
to
so nice.
hang out with him in those
Yeah.
early years. And I wish that we could find some, you know, young producers who still have that. I haven't found them yet. I know they're out there, but I think they're all like going to Columbia, you know, which like has its own like downtrodden kind of energy, you know. So I'm like hoping that, you know, we'll find, and they all have this kind of idea that they all have this idea of kind of, I mean, I don't know if they all do, but it seems like a lot of people are trying to work within the systems that exist to change them. And you're not meeting that many people who are going, oh no, we're going to invent a new way of doing things, you know? And so, yeah, I wish there'd be more of that. We need more of you, Earl. Get out of the ashram.
For better or worse, these systems that we have, they're worth speaking against, but the only way to really replace them is to get rid of them is to replace them with something that actually functions. That, I'm
Yeah, I
curious.
mean, I'm not a throw the baby out with the bathwater person. I think if something in a system works, to keep it. So, you know, I'm not a burn the whole system down type of activist, but I definitely I definitely think if something is systemically racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever it might be, you know, you have to replace it with a different system.
That's what I mean. If you know you're going into a system that hates you and doesn't welcome you, you might be able to get through if you have three, if you have an extra 200 years to live, but if
Yeah,
not, you're kind of done.
yeah.
Do you identify as an activist in any way, Taylor? It's okay if you don't. I'm just curious if you come from any of this as activism, even if it's not like protesting directly. I mean, I feel like you put out, in terms of this performance, there's a lot of subversion, which to me is a form of activism. It's
I
doing
don't
things
think I had
differently.
a choice. I mean, yes, because I didn't have a choice, because there was like either survive or don't survive. You know, so I don't like activism is just part of surviving. It's not something I didn't wake up one day and be like, I'm an activist, you know. I just found myself going, I can't survive in under this model. And so then I need to work with people who are trying to change it.
Do you feel like that is, maybe for both of you, do you feel like that is kind of wired in who you are as a kid, since you're a kid, or is that more tied to queerness? Do you feel like maybe,
For me,
if,
it's 100% queerness. But I mean the, I yeah, I don't I don't know where empathy comes from, because some people have it and some people don't. And I don't I think it's a kid thing. I think so yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I do recognize that there are some people who just don't have a lot of empathy.
I realize I also
And
separated this idea of queerness and you as a kid, and I think they're the same, obviously. So I'm wondering if we did you both know you were queer? I mean, was that apparent from childhood? So was that just always? Yeah. Okay. So that makes more
me.
sense.
I don't know.
What about you? What about you?
I mean, I wouldn't, and I didn't have the language for it, but certainly, I mean, there's like, you know, a photograph of me like 4 years old in my mom's yellow dress with, you know, lipstick smeared across my lips. But yeah, I don't know, just what you were saying about activism and queerness. I mean, I think for myself, that was, you know, I worked at the Village of Arts and Humanities in North Philadelphia. Yeah. Primarily African-American, low-income neighborhood. And I remember at the time, and I was going to Penn, I was studying urban studies. I was really, like, I was so ignorant. I was learning about redlining and all of these, you know, historical factors that contribute to the condition of African-Americans, you know, through to the present day, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember thinking, why do I have so much empathy? Why do I feel these things so deeply? You know, the injustice of redlining and segregation and all of these things. And for me, I just felt it was being queer, you know, to have that sense of being an outsider, of being alienated, of not fitting in, or, you know, and so. And I don't know. I mean, to me, that's like the most capacious version of queerness. You know, it goes back to the Penny Arcade definition of queer. You know, somebody who was ostracized to such an extent that they could never ostracize somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's... I mean, I just read some statistic, and who knows if any of these all are true, but it's actually more like 3% of the population that's queer. And it's a majority of that 3% that are actually bisexual. So if you really want to narrow it down to gay men and lesbian, it's even a way smaller percentage. So it seems like there's so many more of us, but we really are.
Wait,
we're
what
outsiders.
Happened to the 1 in 10? What happened to 1 in 10? Now we're 3 in 100?
Apparently that's not true.
Wait, 3% are queer, 3% are queer and 7% are Chelsea queens?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I can relate.
I mean, you know, like, who knows what it means? It's like ebb and flow, blah, 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 blah. Like, sexuality is not, you know, so easily defined by a chart. But I think there's been this push to say that there's more of us than there actually are. And I think some of the activism of the gay community is that they have said, we're just like you. They're, you know, we're just like you. We're your brothers. We're your sisters. We're your, and I think the difference maybe in our community, it's more like, no, we're different. We're weird. We're strange. We're outsiders. There aren't that many of us.
Yeah.
And that is reason to protect us.
Yeah.
That's reason to have our rights. And that's reason to, you know, be who we are, even more so.
This is a nice segue. Actually, one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about is Bark of Millions, which just had its world premiere at the Sydney Opera House. And I remember seeing... I think it was the first run through of the show when you did the workshop at Mass Mocha, and you were talking about the show and the idea and one of the animating ideas being queer as a metaphor. If I remember correctly, queer as a metaphor for America.
Well, I think I'm always kind of wondering about that. You know, my play here was using a trans person as a metaphor for America, you know, so the idea being that queer people never get to represent anything other than themselves in mass culture. And I was like, well, why couldn't the metaphor be that America's transitioning, you know, because that's what it feels like it's doing, you know, so why couldn't the trans person be the metaphor for America? And so I, with Bark of Millions, I wouldn't necessarily, I think that's always part of the conversation of the work that I'm making a little bit. But I think it, no, I think it's really just a giant meditation on queerness. This show, it's a 4-hour concert of all original songs that I wrote the lyrics for and Matt Ray wrote the music for. And we've got an ensemble of 21 people and there's no banter and we just sing from beginning to end. All the songs are inspired by different queer people from world history.
Oh, wow.
And it's basically like a reverse conversion therapy session where we're just like sing one song inspired by a queer person, another one, another one, another one for 4 hours with the idea that at the end of it, the audience is a little bit more queer that, when they leave than they were when they entered.
That's amazing.
And so that's really all it is. But it's strange that it has this, it has a deep impact. I mean, we'll see. We've only performed the whole thing once. So far, so who knows what actual impact of that us, you know, maybe this is indulgent, but on the performers and the company that is making it, it really is quite been an incredibly profound experience to just sit in meditation of queerness for 4 hours in song.
It's amazing. You know? It's really smart.
Oh, I mean, that was very clear to me just seeing the run through at Mass Mocha, the connection that you had as a community of performers. What else can, I'm just so curious about the show at the Opera House. How did it go? What were the highlights? What was the tea? What happened backstage?
I mean, it was one of the more difficult things I've ever made. It was a lot harder than the 24 Decade show, actually, because with 24 Decade, a lot of that was just on myself, Matt, and Machine, and we were just essentially just wrangling, you know, other people to support the work that we were doing, you know. So I mean, the musicians would come in for a 3-hour rehearsal and that's it, you know, so they didn't have to be there for the, like, you know, all of the rehearsal leading up to it. And we performed more than we met, so we didn't really have a rehearsal process. We would make sure the charts were good, and then we would do a 90-minute show and then talk about it, and then do another show and talk about it. And that's kind of how we rehearsed, was by performing. So there were less meetings and more, there was lots and lots and lots of performing. Whereas this one, especially during the pandemic time and having so many people in it and, you know, paying everybody equitable wages and all of that kind of stuff, it's just been endless logistics and meetings. And it's just, and then you get one performance, you know. We didn't even have a preview performance. We had one performance at the Sydney Opera House, and then we were done. We flew all the way to Sydney, did one show, and then we were done. So it was a lot of it, all the kind of stress and anxiety of building a show without any of the release of the show. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that we get to a place where we get to perform it more than we have to meet about it, because it's but it is, you know, we're also living in this time where everyone wants a 3-person show, not a 21 person show. And, you know, unless you run an opera company where you have a choir already and you have an orchestra already and everyone's getting paid salaries and they're there and you use them all, I mean, this is like building an infrastructure from nothing. So the producing team is, you know, the performing miracles, but like with no support from any of the institutions around the world. The Sydney Opera House didn't give us any money to actually make the show. So they just, you know what I mean? Like, they called it the premiere, but meanwhile, there was no like commissioning support, and none of the theaters are, you know, that have sucks. Come on board, you know, to help commission it. So in some ways it feels like I'm still at the slide, or I'm still at Bar Noir, you know, like I'm still like trying to figure out how to make the impossible happen. It's just with bigger numbers in a bigger theater, but it's, nothing's changed, you know. There's still not support for this very super queer work. So that's my long way of saying that the process was very challenging, But the work itself is incredibly rewarding. And Matt has outdone himself with writing music. It's just every song is so special. And the performers are all so unique and wonderful. And they're just really varied. And there's a lot of historical harm in the room, in the sense that you put a bunch of queer people in a room together, and they're going to bring a lot of pain with them from their childhoods and the way society treats them, and then you're singing about queerness, so that brings up all of that stuff. So people, it's been a real emotional roller coaster, I think, for a lot of people, and trying to identify what is actually is something in the room right now actually harmful, or is it from when you were five, and like identifying like what that is, and how to separate them and move forward has been a real challenge as a director, to kind of just be calm with people. And you know, if someone gets COVID, and then is the whole entire thing going to fall down because one person has the sniffles in their hotel room and everyone's scared, and you know, like, or can we like recognize that the COVID experience is slightly shifted now, or is that irresponsible? And you know, so all of those things have been really very, very challenging. But you know, we do it. But the songs, like, they solve everything. Solve everything. Mm. Yeah, that's my long rant about Mark and Billions.
Yeah. Oh, and has it been announced yet when it will be and where it will be in New York?
I think it's getting announced today. It'll be at the Harvey at BAM this February. So we're going to do one preview show. We get a preview, and then four shows at the Harvey. And then we go to Berkeley to the Zellerbach Hall. So, and then after that, we're hopefully going to Berlin. Wow. In September, and then we're working on trying to get more for other things, you know, but it's not a cheap show, so
yeah.
And it's not commercial, so you know, yeah, not with that cast, yeah, but it's, you know, it's not the kind of thing that's gonna run on Broadway or anything like that, so it's like, you know, it's where you really wish that we had an NEA, you know, that actually supported the arts.
Can you speak of the cast real quick?
The whole singing ensemble is queer except for one person. There's one token, one token ally, she's amazing. She's the queen of Detroit blues, Thornetta Davis. And she's been performing with us. She's in the movie of 20 for Decade too. Wow. And she's just so special. And so I thought, you know, if we're going to have one ally singer, like, well, let's let it be Thornetta. And then the rest of the company is all queer. The singing company, and most of the musicians are too, most of the instrumentalists. And it's everyone from people like Chris Jarmo, who's in American Utopia. He's the redhead, who's David Byrne's backup singer dancer, kind of steals the show, you know, and is so wonderful, and has been a downtown kind of a stalwart for many years, and can do, you know, harmony vocals like nobody. He's so wonderful. And Stephanie Christiane, who is this just rock goddess, also from Detroit, and Mama Alto from Australia, who's this trans woman who's just like has the just I've never heard a voice like this. It's a jazz voice, but it's just so it's where like a trans voice can be is its own sound, has its own unique beauty to it, that it sounds like nobody else. She sounds like nobody else I've ever heard. It just kind of does something to your DNA when you listen to her. And then Legato Chocolat, who is a queen from Nigeria that lives in Brighton, and who I met at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival many, many years ago, and has been a dear friend. So, and he's got this bass voice that's, so he's kind of operatic bass voice, and he's extraordinary. Then there's Jack Fuller, who's been around New York for years, but nobody knows anything about Jack, and Jack is one of the great talents I've ever encountered in my life. And Jules Skloot, who's this wonderful, Jules is a dancer, a trans man is a dancer, but you know, we were looking for dancers because we're working with Faye Driscoll on a little choreography here and there in the piece, and so I thought I'd get Jules and Sean Donovan to be part of it, the kind of dancers. But when I heard Jules sing, I just, he broke my heart. Wow. That voice is just, again, it's that voice that is so different from other voices, so vulnerable. And it's a particular kind of trans voice that is, that we just don't get to hear that often in the world. So it's really special having Jules be part of it. And, you know, and then also, you know, when we cast all these people, then I was able to kind of start to craft some of the lyrics around what they could do. And Matt was able to craft the music around what they are able to do. So it feels like some of the songs are just like little gifts to them too. So. And there's so many. Al Bay, someone who was from the Bay Area, that's just one of my favorite human beings on the planet, and a great performer that I met doing the Lily's Revenge out there, and was in the Hang with us
Dazzle.
In New York City. And Machine Dazzle did all the costumes, and is and in the show
on
and
stage too.
And Machine is magnificent in the show. It's an incredible performer, and he has Machine. You know, not. I mean, I think people kind of know this about Machine, but not that many people know what good timing Machine has. He's like got such great stage timing, and he's just a delight. And and the costumes, again, you know, he always outdoes himself. So I feel silly just acting like, oh yeah, he outdoes himself, but he just does over and over again.
Yeah.
Just like, how is it possible? And the costumes are just exquisite. So. So that's what we're doing. It's really moving, the show, I wish we had a little bit more support.
A lot more support.
Poor
Linda Broombach. She's really making miracles happen. At Pomegranate Arts. But yeah, speaking of Machine, I guess that's a nice segue back to the 24-hour show documentary.
Yeah.
Machine has some really great moments in the documentary.
Oh yes.
Machine is, I mean, Machine should have his own reality TV show. Like, screw those competition shows, just like sit and watch Machine make things an hour every week. Screw trying to win, just like just watching him is winning.
Yeah.
So can you speak a little bit to how the two of you worked together on the 24-hour show? I mean, those costumes are so phenomenal.
Yeah. And well, I try to work this way with all my designers, and it's a hard way to work because it takes time and years, I think, to develop the trust and the kind of shifting that you have to do. But I don't like to tell Machine what to do. So I just say, this is what I'm doing. This is the circumstance of the work. And this is when I need it. And then, you know, inevitably it shows up a week late. or as I'm walking onto the stage. But I never tell Machine, you know, I don't say Machine doesn't make me something and then I say, great, can I get that in orange? You know, like, I'm never going to do that. Like, Machine doesn't tell me how to write my plays or my performance pieces. So I'm not going to tell Machine how to design. So I just wear whatever Machine gives me. And So I just say I'm making a 24-hour show, and every decade, every hour of the show, it represents a different decade. And this decade, you know, is about Walt Whitman and Stephen Foster, and we're kind of doing a mashup and WWF whatever takedown of the two, like a wrestling match. And so that's the circumstance, and the machine makes me an outfit that's like Walt Whitman with potato chips and porn, and you know, and but it has like that checkerboards on it to kind of represent the competition between the two, and it, you know, and it's just its own metaphor. And I just wear it because it's like, why wouldn't I want to, you know? It's, I mean, yeah. And the great thing about machines over the years is that back in the early, when we first started working together in the early aughts, you know, I would walk away with stabs and cuts, and I'd be actually bleeding, and you know, like rashes, and it's like the queen didn't understand lining, you know. But now she does know about lining, so now like you don't even get harmed by the outfits anymore.
Oh,
yeah. I don't know. Machine. I met. Machine was a dazzle dancer, so we met in the downtown scene. At, you know, at the Slide, or maybe at Cheese Whiz. Maybe at the Parkside Lounge. Is maybe where
Parkside
I met
Lounge. Machine. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's very special.
yeah, I don't know. I just like, it's I was in getting ready for this. I was looking at some things online and came across like your the piece from Red Tide Blooming, Lynn Chaney, your love song between Lynn Chaney and Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
And then there's the
I have a recording. So Bridget Everett played Lynn Chaney in the first musical that I wrote. And I have this I have a recording of her singing The Palace of the which is fun.
Oh, I would love to hear that. And then the piece about But I Loved Him, there's a video of me performing that at Soho Rep. And I don't know, it was so, it just like really took me back. You know, yeah. And I think like that was, it's interesting because, you know, something like the 24-hour show is such a big, you know, so many people and you know, at St. Anne's, the production values, I mean, the lighting, the costumes, the band, it was so extraordinary. And still, I mean, I don't know that I've had the opportunity to say this, but, you know, I was so impressed at how queer it was, you know, that something that was, it hadn't been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize at that point, but, you know, as you have enjoyed more, I mean, I guess, for want of a better term, mainstream success, you know, I mean, the tendency oftentimes is for people to assimilate or maybe tone things down a bit, and you know, and you have a giant, you know, what was it, like 50-foot penis floating out above the you know, the audience, and a song that's an ode to backroom sex, and I was just, you know, and people were, you know, I mean, of course it's New York, it's Brooklyn, you know, the straight folks, the, you know, the older people, everybody was just eating
and
it
it's
up.
It's at
it was
least
wonderful.
10 years before Troy Sivan.
But, you know, but it was interesting just like looking at those older pieces and thinking about those just you solo on the ukulele, you know, for people who aren't familiar with that piece, And I Loved Him, you go through, you know, sort of a litany of lovers and you know really you know, some sort of outrageous things about the, you know, the one who stuck crystal meth up your ass while you were sleeping, but I loved him, you know. But I think like that was, again, you know, was so just so astonishing to hear and see somebody articulating these very specific and somewhat taboo sorts of queer experiences, but it was also, it felt so liberating, you know? And I think that's why there were so many people like Machine and Maddie Crossland, and, you know, there were, you know, a gaggle of queers that really just, you know, were so drawn to you in that work. And I think, you know, that you know, just the vulnerability and the honesty and the rawness of it, you know, but it's nice to see that, you know, though the work has changed, grown, you know, what have you, there, I think there's still something at the core that has been, there's a continuity there in terms of that the queer experience that you're articulating in the work, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lou. Yeah, I don't, I mean, I'm doing a commercial project right now that doesn't allow me to be as, I mean, I just had this kind of slight debate with somebody that there's no such thing as art on Broadway. And they were like, but what about Hamilton? You know, I was like, well, when you make, you know, when you make a lot of your decisions based on commerce, it changes the content. The content. And so if the content is about what will sell, then that's the content. And I don't view that as art.
No.
It can be artistic and it's creative. And I'm not saying there's not a reason to do it necessarily, but I can't call it art. And so I think that's what I've been learning as I decided to do a commercial project, which was like, oh, let me try to make this as artistic and creative and interesting as I can within the content of it being commerce.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm learning what I want to do in my life and future, and you don't know what you want until you experiment, you know. So, it's at Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. It's a Broadway musical version. Yeah. And I'll say I've had way more fun in rehearsals for that show than I've had for any show that I've ever done. And I think it's partially just because every day in rehearsal is like watching a Broadway musical. You know, you're like, yay, I get to have fun today. I just get to go to a Broadway musical and watch people do high kicks and like sing songs. And, you know, it's like, I'm emotionally invested in the show, and people being taken care of and it working and it offering up something to a larger world that is special. But I'm not emotionally invested in somebody saying a line the right way. I'm just like, yay. Like, well, no, it's not. I'm not even going to make a lot of money off of it, you know, because like the saying on Broadway is you make a killing or, you know, you can't make a living. Yeah. And it's true. I mean, I've put 5 years of work into it and I definitely didn't get paid for 5 years of work. So, and the chances that it will become some show that, you know, runs for 20 years is, you know, that happens once every 20 years for a show. So it's not, it's very unlikely that I'll make money off of it. So it was really, money was not the consideration. And yet money decides a lot of the decisions. It's so fascinating to me. So I said I wanted to do it because I wanted to, because Midnight in the Garden, when I was a young person, it was the first major queer thing I'd ever seen. I ever experienced. I mean, you know, like reading the book and that it was a bestseller for so long, and I'd never seen America embrace anything queer before. So to me, it had an impact, and so I thought I wanted to hang out with that for a while, you know, which was the real reason why I said yes, because it's this weird eccentric community down there at this time. And because the ideas in the book of preservation and and how we preserve things and why we preserve them is a fascinating American story. So, you know, there were like real solid reasons I said yes. And yet I'm working in commerce. So it's very, it's a odd thing to navigate. So that's just my way of saying that it's also really nice to balance that out with just super queer work. Just like have a movie on HBO that's super fucking queer and not gay, but queer, you know?
But it also must be nice to do a project like that without having to do all of the work. Without having to, you know, if you not having to drive, not having to, like having to it's do a project where, so where you're just able to go nice. And do one thing must be really nice, even if you're not, you know, I mean, my joke, you know, I was thinking about it. I was like, oh, I guess you're doing more Broadway to, you know, you'll get money to balance out. I'm like, wait, it's Broadway. He's not getting paid for this, really. But yeah, anyway, I mean, but back to you guys. But
I love it. I mean,
it sounds really amazing. It sounds like, yeah.
When does the show open?
Midnight. It's making its premiere in Chicago, kind of out of town tryout thing in June, in July, this summer. So we're getting it ready. You know, we're getting it ready. We got we got some great people in it already, and Jason Robert Brown wrote the music and lyrics.
Oh wow!
So it's
I like him.
It's some fun. Some great material and
did you write the book, Ben?
I wrote the book.
Wow.
Yeah, which is my first kind of experience of writing a book for a
that's really cool
for a Broadway musical, you know. And I thought, well, I want to learn how to do this. It's, you know, I'm not sure it's what I want to do with my life, but I'm happy for the experience.
Are you a fan of his work? Are you a fan of like 13 or what's the one? Oh, the one about the couple. Do you know his work?
You know,
at all?
The only one I really knew was Parade when I signed on, because my roommate, my old roommate, was in the original production right out of acting school. He got cast in the chorus of that, and so I knew that one pretty well.
Okay, nice.
And I think Jason is kind of the bridge between Sondheim and the younger generation, in the sense that he really does know the all of the ways that a musical is built, and you know he holds all of the he holds the knowledge of the older generation, and so I thought, yeah, I need to have an experience working with him so that I can, because I want to learn all that stuff, you know.
I've been a Broadway freak since I always joke that because I live in Philadelphia, my Jewish parents are legally required to take us a seat to Broadway every 3 times a year when I was a kid. But I mean, I you know, that could be a whole separate conversation. But he is someone I feel like is coming. I agree with you. Is, you know, coming from being mentored from the likes of Sondheim. I also feel like William Finn fits in there a lot in there. But
yeah,
he's my Elvis for Broadway.
You know, oh yeah, well, there's, I mean, there's certain, you know, a certain generation that holds the kind of keys and information of what making a traditional kind of musical takes, and you know, that craft. It's all written in books. It's not like it's going away, but to have firsthand experience with it is moving. Moving to me anyway.
Nice.
So you know, I don't know why do gay people love musicals so much. I don't know.
And
I
mean, Jews, it's weird,
more Jew, more older hate relationship with them, but I
more, you know, older Jewish people go to theater than gay, but I don't know.
It's,
I mean,
part of the Yiddish theater tradition.
I think I think if you, to answer your first question, I mean, being a sensitive, you know, Jewish kid, Broadway was, it was my, it's rock and roll to me. It's punk. I look at Broadway as punk in a lot of ways. And I don't know what it was. It spoke right into my soul. I don't know if that's more an issue of like being a sensitive male or being a gay male. I don't assume all men that are queer are sensitive, but more like,
no,
they
I
are.
Mean, most of the gay men that I know don't like musicals. So like, I think that stereotype is so funny to me, because like all of the New York, like martini gays that I know are like,
is that because of the stereotype of
musicals are so tacky? No, they like
they just hate it
in Philip Glass.
You've never you've clearly never been over to Lady Rimmelauer's apartment and at 2 a.m. and watch endless Patti LuPone videos on VHS tape.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
give it to me. Shoot it into my veins. Yeah, there's certain stuff I couldn't get enough of. Patti LuPone, I don't know what it is. She can do no wrong for me.
How do you feel about Company? I'm assuming if you like Sondheim, the Company is probably up there. I feel like Company is the one show that seems in his work to.
Actually like it. I mean, I like parts of it. I think parts of it are genius, as a whole, I don't tend to like Sondheim musicals on a whole. I like their songs. I like lyrics. I like sections of music. I like, you know, I think certain aspects of them are just unbelievable. And then, but as a whole, I'm always like, yeah, it doesn't work.
Have you gotten to see a strange?
Oh, that's a hot take, Taylor. Yes. Hot take.
Have you gotten to see A Strange Loop?
I did, yeah.
Speaking of what are your feelings on that? If you're willing to share.
Well, I didn't see it on Broadway, but the off Broadway, I loved it. I loved it, and I thought, wow, this is what we were doing at PS 122, but now it's at Playwrights Horizons, and so I thought for me. And I don't imagine most of the audience would feel this way, but there was this sense of, wow, how did he do this? How did he convince Playwrights Horizons to do this? How did he convince this audience that this should win a Pulitzer and a Tony? Like, I thought it deserved it, you know, like what, like it wasn't any question of whether it deserved it, but having come from such resistance to this type of work my entire career, I was like, how did he do it? that's I was just really looking at it from like he fooled all those board members.
I haven't seen the musical itself, which I need to, but that the songs in there, I mean, especially the song Memory, to me that is in the top three. There's probably five musicals that I feel like have, not only my favorite, have defined the generations. I feel like, you know, but that one to me is up there in five. And also Book of Mormon. What are your thoughts on that? Because that to me, I guess it's weird because I feel like Book of Mormon, they used the Disney, you know, platform to be very subversive. And I thought that's why it did well. But I mean, I saw that on a Wednesday. You know, I spent a lot of money on the ticket, and it was mostly old people, and it was like a rock show. Do you think was there something about that kind of got through?
It, so I couldn't speak to.
It's pretty fucking. It's very subversive. It's very subversive. It's no. Anyway, but are there any musicals that are your kind of top any recent favorites? Any songs, even if it's not necessarily.
I don't know. I like Carousel.
There you go. I don't know why I like Carousel. That's going to be the name of the episode. Do you? What about you, Earl? Do you go back to Broadway at all? I mean, you did just give me a reference from Chorus.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was a Bernadette Peters queen, and I mean, I still love Bernadette Peters. Yeah. I saw Bernadette Peters at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts when I lived in Los Angeles, and I just saw. You know, when she was like, no one is alone or whatever, you know, and she just like put so much emotion.
Yeah,
and it's interesting because at the time, I was also a big fan of Melissa Etheridge. And I thought, this is interesting, but they both like really connect with emotion and a sense of longing, which I think goes back to being queer. It is particularly like in, you know, the 80s, being a teenager in the 80s, you know, Ellen wasn't out, Melissa Etheridge wasn't out, you know, it was like, Rock Hudson was outed because he had AIDS. You know what I mean? There were not. I mean, I see things now on television or, you know, recording artists, and I just am like, you know, a show like Transparent or, you know, any number of things. RuPaul's Drag Race, even though I'm not a fan, I just think, wow, how different would my experience growing up have been if I had access to all those things? So I think the longing in a Melissa Etheridge song, you know, the longing in a Bernadette Peters ballad, you know, I just really, as a young queer, really connected to that. And a funny two little aside story. During the Rodney King riots, I was living in Los Angeles, and I had just bought the CD for Mac and Mabel, starring Bernadette Peters, the original cast recording with Bernadette Peters. And like a week later, my manager at Hugo's on Santa Monica Boulevard said, "Oh, can you get this table ready? These regulars at the restaurant are coming in with Bernadette Peters." I was beside myself. So
oh, wow.
I drove on my break down to the Beverly Center to Schubert Alley, which is like a Broadway memorabilia store. I got the poster for Sunday in the Park with George. I went back to my post at the counter at Hugo's restaurant, had a Sharpie, the poster and a Sharpie in a bag. And they came in, they sat down, and I didn't want to interrupt. I didn't want to be intrusive. But then Bernadette Peters went to the bathroom. And when she went to the bathroom,
I got into
position. So when she came out, I was there with my poster and my Sharpie.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And I said, "Hi, Miss Peters. You know, I was just, you know, listening to Mac and Mabel through the Rodney King riots, through the curfew, and you really got me through it. I wonder if you would sign this poster for me." And, you know, I'm sure she's used to people coming up to the stage door with a poster or a playbill, but like at a restaurant, someone just randomly happens to have a poster of Sunday.
It's awesome.
George. Oh, and I said, "Could you sign it to Earl? Just keep moving on."
Just keep moving on,
Bernadette Peters. I did have an affinity for musical theater.
You're speaking to longing, though, and I think that's what it is. It's like music doesn't happen without longing, you know, especially vocal music. And so when you hear somebody sing and you hear someone sing with their soul, then what you're hearing is their longing. And it's so and even like wanting the longing of wanting her to sign the poster is, you know, like it's just such a, we're constantly longing for some kind of connection. And I think that's a little bit what Earl did, what you did in those, you know, early days of all that scene was, you were like, you were longing for connection and we were all longing for connection, but didn't have anybody to wrangle us all together. So, you know, you did. I still, you know, as chaotic and crazy as it was, I mean, our trip to Los Angeles to perform at that crazy place and our trip to San Francisco to perform at the museum, at the MoMA, where like all of the...
Can we hear some of these stories? Hear some of these stories, if you don't mind? Can we get into some of these stories if you're willing to share that are about both of you?
I have this picture of, it's like Justin Vivian Baum, Penny Arcade,
Gia Wyatt.
Gia Wyeth and
Daniel Isengard,
Sheen Dazzle and Daniel, and you know, it's like all of these downtown queerdos all just like at the airport all together.
we had a Virgin America sponsorship.
Laird got ready on the plane, and so you know, this is a time before RuPaul's Drag Race, so it wasn't like you saw queer people on social media everywhere or anything. I think it was maybe.
Oh, and I do remember. So it was a show called Weimar New York, and you know, it was the second Bush administration, and it was a theatrical cabaret drawing uneasy parallels between the rise of fascism, you know, between the world wars, and conservative. You know, the political conservative climate in the United States. I mean, it seems quaint now, the idea, you know, but anyway, no. the show was booked by Frank Schnegel at the SF MoMA, and it was co-hosted by Justin Vivian Bond and Animatronic from the Scissor Sisters.
Right, Animatronic, yeah.
And we flew out on Virgin Airlines. They were a sponsor, and I remember that we drank the plane out of booze. All of the booze was gone by the time we landed in San Francisco.
But it was like we just all continually, I mean, we just continually long for connection. But in our, you know, Penny's generation, they were all in the neighborhood together. They all had apartments down the street from each other. They could hang out on a stoop and just see their friend walk by and hang out. And it wasn't difficult and challenging. They all went to the same bars and the clubs. And now we're so spread out all over. And so there isn't really a sense of community. So I think one of the things that, you know, I think my shows have done, and I certainly know what Earl's work has done, is it's like just been about like, can we get everybody together? How do we get everybody together still so that we can bounce off of each other with ideas and art and considerations, you know? And that's the big challenge in this day and age, where it's not online, and it's actually in person, where we can physically touch each other and be with each other. And because feeling someone's DNA is very different from feeling somebody's digital Pixel. Platform. Yeah.
It's such a caring and smart way to operate, because a lot of people are like, they can't let go. You know, as an artist, as a curator, whatever it is, they have. And I think when you don't let go, you don't get the best from people. When you manage it, it sucks.
Yeah, you can't try to force. You can invite everyone to a party and then force them to behave. Then it's not a party.
I mean, for sure, that was my MO. I mean, I would see artists whose work I liked, it resonated for some reason, and then it was just like, yeah, come and do your thing. Or, you know, maybe for the Weimar shows, you know, there would be a particular number that, you know, kind of made sense thematically, and I might ask, you know, the artist to do that number. But, you know, certainly, like I did, you know, for several years, a party called Pussy Faggot, and that was, you know, mayhem, 20 performers, DJs, installation artists, whatever. But, you know, there was never, it was just like, come do what you want to do, which, you know, didn't always, like, I did a joint thing with a couple of other promoters, a party called Hey Queen and a party called Spank. We did a pride thing at public assembly, and I had the pussy faggot room. And I remember I had Raul de Nieves, Colin Self, and Mickey Blanco doing a performance together. And they cleared the room. You know, they were.
It was like nobody
funny.
Went, everyone all, left.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all enjoying various degrees of success now, you know, but they just were, you know, doing something that was really confrontational and dissonant. And I loved it. But, you know, my co-promoters were kind of like, what's going on here? You know, like people are fleeing.
People are fleeing that room.
And I loved it. You know what I mean? But this kind of goes back to what you were saying about commerce. And I think that for myself, in terms of, you know, for many reasons, I kind of, you know, moved away from that world and that work. But I think that, you know, my attitude and approach was always, hey, gang, let's put on a show. And I, as you know, was never really thinking about the financial aspect of it. And that, caught, you know, but I just, you know, at a certain point, I realized like I could not figure out how to reorient the work that I was doing to put the profit motive at the front, because it never had been. And maybe somebody else could have figured out how to do that. But for me, I felt like to do that would fundamentally alter what it was I was doing, you know? Yeah. And I just, I couldn't figure out how to make it work.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think about it all the time, like, is there a way I could make theater without paying anybody? Not because I don't want people to get paid, but because I don't want to fucking have a meeting. I don't want to have a contract. I don't want to have a piece of paper. I want to like find the joy in making again, instead of the weight of capitalism being on everything? Do we eliminate money from the joy of making? And, you know, I don't think it's practical for me in the position that I'm in, because I won a MacArthur, so I have money. So it's not, so I can't tell other people, hey, work for free, you know, for the great just joy of it. Like, I just can't like do that.
But I do think
if I was Needle Jones, I could.
Oh my God.
But I do think, you know, when I saw the Bark of Millions at Mass Mocha, I really did think, like, because, you know, I was talking to Linda afterwards, Taylor's brilliant producer at Pomegranate Art.
A brilliant producer. Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And, you know, I just like, I just talking to her, I was so stressed out. I was just like, oh my God, you know, like, the just trying to raise the amount of money that's required for this company, and the fact that, you know, so many places are not commissioning work like this now. And I was just like, it was exciting to talk to her about the work, it was exciting to see the work, but I was just like, oh, I'm so happy not to be like doing this,
yeah,
you know, and not having the weight of this response. But I was also thinking, like, oh, I would just love to see you and your musicians and your artists in like a you know, like a what is it when you get the grease from McDonald's, the reuse, the oil, the buses that run on, like, you know,
right, what, recycled,
and you're just like just recycled, yeah, you're just like in an old converted school bus and you're just going from town to town.
Oh my God. It would be, I mean, yeah, that to me is like the fantasy that would be a nightmare in a reality, but the fantasy is definitely that you know, I want to be on the wheel, you know, I want to like but oh, I don't, you know, it's just, when the pandemic happened and everyone was getting paid $600 a week to survive, all the artists that I knew, that was the time when there was happiness in art. There were musicians on the street performing for free all the time, and it felt not immoral to ask a friend to come and play music with you without having to pay them, because it was just part of the system, because the government was paying artists to do what they do. Yeah. So the people, not the government, you know, the people were paying, collectively paying artists to make their lives better, right? To make everybody's lives better by making art available, culture available to everybody. So it's really the only solution is that it's of the people, for the people, by the people, that the people will then collectively pull in their sense to help bring culture into our lives so that we don't have to pay $200 to see fucking musical that we don't love, you know, like, yeah. Instead it's like there for you, available everywhere, and so that's the only solution, and I don't see it happening in America.
Let me just thank you both. I'm sorry, I tell her, you were just so kind and vulnerable, and it was just, you know, just a pleasure hearing you talk about it. I could see how much love you have. I could see how, even though it's a struggle, you do it. And Earl, you're also someone I've always, you know, I always known, always respected, always really just thought was a very positive force.
Pleasure to follow, and a pleasure to follow in the footsteps of Anne Magnuson.
I can't even begin to tell you how much of an honor that was to talk to her. She is one of the smartest, creative, awesome, sensitive people I've ever fucking met in my life. And that's when I really felt like I had something, getting to her. So thank you so much for being part of it. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
You guys have a great day.
Thank you.
Talk to you.
Bye,
Taylor. Nice to see you. Say hi to Pat.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thank you so much. I just want to let you know about, we're having a big kind of, we're calling it our bar mitzvah celebration. It is for the whole month, but we're doing a special weekend. On February, from February 23rd to 25th, we've got a live Zoom for around 50 people, and we'll give you information about how to join that, with the amazing Rainbow Connection writer himself, Paul Williams. We'll be talking a little bit about his work in Phantom of Paradise and some other stuff he's done. We'll be talking to one of my favorite photographers, Meryl Meisler. We'll talk about her work. We're bringing in Kevin Allison to talk about, you know, do some storytelling. There's a lot of great things happening. We'll be putting up a formal list soon. But again, keep an eye out, February 23rd to 25th. We're very lucky right now. We got some really great episodes coming out. We just released one with Michael Verratti and Peaches Christ, who do Midnight Mass. And then also I got to talk to Peaches Christ. We're helping to promote a series of shows in the East Coast for Peaches and Mink Stole. Mink Stole is cool as hell to talk to. What a nice person. What a chill lady. It was so great talking to them. And their tour starts in California on the 10th and goes to the 20th. It'll be in the East Coast. And it'll be coming to New York, Providence, Salem, New York, and Philly, and then Washington. And if you need more information about that, you can check our page or go to peacheschrist.com. Thanks again for your support. If you want to give us some money, we really always need it. I lose a few thousand dollars a year doing this, but I wouldn't have it any other way. This has been a dream come true. Enjoy. Talk to you soon. Until next week. We thought indifferent.